Oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 16-7013, Fox Television Stations, Inc. et al. Versus Film On TV Networks, Inc. et al. Appellants Alquiviedes David, Mr. Baker for the appellants, Mr. Katyal for the appellee.
Mr. Baker. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Baker. I represent the defendants and the appellants, Film On X, and the related Film On entities. In 1976, Congress revised the Copyright Act, which had stood since 1909. And in making those revisions, Congress recognized that technologies were changing. In 1976, the new disruptive technology was traditional cable. Today, we have new and additional disruptive technologies as they've continued to evolve at an ever-increasing pace. Congress, when it revised the Act in 1976, knew that technology would not stop evolving, that it would continue to develop, and that, in fact, it would probably continue to develop at an increasing pace as it has. Therefore, Congress looked forward and used language in drafting the compulsory license that's found in Section 111F3, using broad language to encompass technological change. The plaintiffs in this case, the appellees here, want us to look backwards and shackle ourselves to the technology of 1976, which they call traditional cable. That flies in the face of the statutory language. This court should give meaning to that language, which the district court did not, should not add additional terms such as direct, which the district court repeats throughout its opinion. There's no requirement for a closed transmission path in the language of 111F3, nor is there any requirement for a local-to-local transmission in that section. Those requirements and other requirements are found in other legislation, such as the Communications Act. But Film On X and other over-the-top providers aren't required to comply with those provisions at this time. That's something that's being considered by the FCC.
I ask you to explain to me, just in a technical way, how I get how you have a building that has an antenna that brings in, that captures the transmission, the broadcast transmissions for the purpose of the first half of F3. Can you explain to me then how it gets from that captured antenna within your, what you call your facility, your building? How does it get transmitted out as a physical matter? Is it, I know you've got the individual antennas and all that, is it going, are they hooked up to cables, wires? How is it getting out of the facility to the customer?
Yes, Judge Miller, I'll do my best. I'm not a technical expert, but I will try. So the signals are received by an antenna, as the district court found, and then they are taken into a facility, a literal building that actually resides in each of the communities which Film On X served and which it intends and would like to continue to serve. That signal is then taken into some equipment that processes the signal and then prepares it for retransmission using IP technology, which then is transferred over wires and cables to a point at which it then passes on to the internet.
Well, and then where is that point, and what do you mean when you say it passes on to the internet?
Well, again, in somewhat layman's terms, if you can envision this room and there being an antenna on the roof of this building, the signal is received, it comes into this room where there's equipment that then transfers or somehow translates that signal, and again, I'm way out of my pay grade here, but I'm doing my best. So it translates that signal into packets of information that are then transferred from that equipment through wires and cables to a point at which we reach the end of the building, mm-hmm. and then there are internet service providers mm-hmm. that Film On X engages to provide service to it, therefore, so it's able to access the internet. Those packets of information then pass onto the internet and are transferred directly through the internet to the subscriber, and only that subscriber is able to view those packets of information. Nobody else is able to view them.
I'm still not quite understanding what you mean when you say you hook up then to service internet service providers. Aren't they then continuing to send the information through cables and wires to their customers? Or, I mean, it, it's described a lot of times on the internet like it's just going out into the air. But my assumption is that it's either using cables, wires, or radio waves all the way until it lands on a customer's computer.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, the experts in this case have agreed that the physical layer of the internet is comprised of wires, cables, and microwaves. And so it is those wires, cables, and microwaves that then Filmenix utilizes with IP technology, again, which I can't unfortunately really understand or explain at this point. That information is then passed from FilmOnX and goes only to the end user. And that's, I think, the most important thing to realize here, because the cases that are cited about the internet, ACLU versus Reno, that's a 1997 case. And in 1997, in fact, that case describes a new emerging internet technology as the World Wide Web. It describes AOL and Prodigy as the ways that we get on the internet using a cable modem. So to look at that case, or frankly to look at IVI 5 years ago, which had starkly different facts from the facts before the court here, is error, is wrong.
Under your theory, what means of retransmission would not be a communications channel? And therefore, what system that uses such retransmissions would not be a cable system?
Well, first of all, any system that didn't have paying subscribers. So this idea of the kid in the dorm room who could arguably have a facility, if that person met all the other requirements and had paying subscribers that, and utilized the internet, that could be. There's nothing against, again, looking at the words of 111F3, a cable system.
So if that kid on the internet had a video club where all of his friends around the world paid him money for him to retransmit, that he would be a cable system?
Well, no, Your Honor, not around the world, and that's
within the United States.
Well, again, one of the concerns that has troubled the courts in these cases and it troubled IVI was this notion, and what IVI wanted to do, and I'll get to the question, I think this answers it. What IVI wanted to do was transmit simultaneously across the country. It had no intention of restricting its transmissions, and it had no intention, it stated.
On your theory, the words localized that part of the views of the Copyright Office also don't apply. Those aren't, in your view, those aren't in the statute, right?
Correct. I think
under your view, it could be nationwide, isn't that right?
I believe that's true, Your Honor. And in fact, but that's not what Filmon intends to do here, because Filmon recognizes
this may be a way of restricting a decision, but let's leave out the nationwide. Your view, though, is it could be nationwide, right? There's nothing in the statute that would bar you from doing that?
Under Section 111F3,
yeah,
that's true. There is a separate mechanism for the transmission of distant signals. And also, I think that actually Section 111 contemplates transmissions that go outside of market. But there are a whole host of other rights, and this is where the FCC steps in. And as we've identified,
we're worried about your interpretation of the statute for a minute. Now let's get back to the kid in the basement. What if he's just doing it in his local community?
If he has equipment and has...
All he needs would be an antenna and a computer console and what's necessary to send it out into the internet, right?
Well, he would need...
Paying subscribers.
Yeah, a facility.
No, I was assuming paying subscribers.
Right. The definition of facility, if that would be an open question, frankly, if solely a computer could constitute a facility. Again, and I keep going back to the precedent here because I think that's where this body of law is sort of leaving the rails. In IVI, there was no facility, and both the district court and the circuit court recognized.
What do you think facility means? Why isn't, under your theory, why wouldn't the kid in the basement with the internet connection be, why wouldn't his house be a facility? Does that have to be commercial in some bigger sense? Is there something?
Well, that's certainly not in the statute.
Right.
So I think there's a test that has to be applied, and I think that test has to be applied by the courts.
We're the courts here, so I'm trying to figure out.
Yes, I understand. And so if I may, the finding of the district court here, it's on the sealed record required appendix.
I don't want the finding of the district. I want you to tell me what you think the statute means. If we were to adopt your view, I want to know how far it goes. Would it cover a kid in the basement with an antenna, computer, and an internet connection?
I would have to say in that instance it might. But those are not the facts before this court.
What's the story on Netflix? I thought your brief was a little cagey on this, saying that the early version wouldn't be, didn't say about the current version. Do you think Netflix is a cable system?
I think Netflix could be, but it's not streaming broadcast television. It's not streaming live stream broadcast television. So instead, it's more video on demand. Mm-hmm. So it's not a cable system.
Because it's not, I'm just trying to get the words, but because it's not receiving signals broadcast by one or more television broadcast stations?
And then retransmitting them to paying subscribers, correct.
Right. So if it did that instead of its current model, which is to pay for licenses.
If it did that from facilities, then yes, Your Honor, to paying subscribers, absolutely.
What about the early mail order version of Netflix?
Our contention is that that would not qualify.
Why not?
Because that would not be another communications channel. And this is where we get into...
The post office a communications channel?
Well, so there's an argument here about justem generis. And while we don't adopt the argument that's made by the plaintiffs in this case, that communications channels is limited, because under their rationale, communications channels has no meaning because it's only wires, cables, and microwave. Under our rationale, we agree that there is some report that we need to take from wires, cables, and microwave and apply that to communications channels. So we're talking about electronic communications channels. And in fact, again, in light of the experts' agreement here that communications channels, or that the internet rather, is made up in its physical layer of wires, cables, and microwave, to preclude a retransmitter that utilizes the internet from accessing the license under the plain language of the statute eviscerates the language of other communication channels. And as a practical matter, common sense, we have to also apply common sense here. The internet is the means by which all of us communicate today more than any other method. And one more point, and I understand I'm into my reserved time.
What about the idea that Congress, when new technologies have come along, has updated the statute, and they make a big deal about that's what should happen here as well, and it hasn't happened yet?
Yes, and it's happened a couple of times. It's happened with satellites, and it's happened with microwave. And in satellites, when the Georgia District Court found first that there was no license, the case was appealed, the Copyright Office then started a formal rulemaking. The circuit court then found there was a license, but then the Copyright Office issued a formal notice rulemaking, which has not been had here. No formal notice rulemaking on this issue directly here. There was. Then the circuit court followed. Meanwhile, I assume there were efforts on Capitol Hill. I wasn't involved with those. I don't know the details of those. But Congress did set up a separate statutory regime, Section 119, for satellite retransmissions.
They haven't done that here. I'm going to loop in the Copyright Office now. The Copyright Office has had a consistent interpretation, maybe not authoritative for Chevron purpose, maybe not, but in any event, consistent for a long time, and Congress has yet to update the statute on this technology.
Well, let me say briefly a couple more things about the satellite. When Congress enacted Section 119, it stated, "Nothing in this act is intended to reflect any view concerning whether prior to enactment or following termination, satellites could get a 111 license." So they reserved that issue. On microwaves, when Congress stepped in, it was, again, only after a formal notice rulemaking, and I'll get back to the Copyright Office.
They thought the Copyright Office was wrong.
Was unnecessarily restrictive in its reasoning, in its reading, because the Copyright Office in that instance had said microwaves can't apply because they're not local. And Congress said no. That's not what this statute means.
What about the Chevron question generally on the Copyright Office? Because one of the strongest arguments they have is the Copyright Office is the responsible agency here, and they have had a consistent interpretation, and why should we court upend that at this point?
I have a lot to say about that. Let me first say, since I'm running out of time,
You'll have.
Okay.
You have enough time. The judges can ask questions as long as they
Thank
want.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I can answer them. First and foremost, we disagree categorically with the notion that Congress, or the Copyright Office, rather, has been consistent on this issue. In the 2008 Shvera report, when it came time to renew the Satellite Act, Congress was considering Verizon, Fios, and AT&T U-verse, systems that undisputably utilize the Internet or IP technology.
The other side says that they use IP, that is, they use packet switching, but they use cables. They use fiber optics, for example, Verizon Fios.
And to that I would say, today I'll be flying out of Dulles, and I'll have my phone, and I can watch the March Madness tournament on my phone. There's no cable that's connected to it, and AT&T or Verizon doesn't control the Wi-Fi hub at the airport. So this notion that somehow there's this traditional cable that still exists and all of us are tethered to a wire is simply make-believe. It's not true anymore. It might have been true when ACLU versus Reno came out, or even 5 years ago when the IVI cases were being considered, but it's not true anymore. But the Copyright Office, in its 2008 Shapiro report, stated and recognized that AT&T U-verse and Verizon Fios were both national in scope, and they were quite different from traditional cable providers. Yet, later in that same report, the office concluded that AT&T U-verse and Verizon Fios may use the Section 111 license. That's categorically different from what the plaintiffs say that they've said all along and what they've been saying. And it's also important to note, as
suppose they had, though, and I take your point on this, the consistency, so you made your point, and that's a good point. But suppose they had been consistent, what about the question of Chevron deference to this office? Or to this interpretation, I should say.
Well, first and foremost, we don't think the statute's ambiguous. I understand that there are differing views of that, and the courts have differed on that. And obviously, we differ in this courtroom on either sides of the table here. So we don't view that there's any need to consult the Copyright Office where the statute's clear. And so there's no gap under Orca Bay and City of Arlington.
I assume it's ambiguous. What's your next argument?
Well, if it's found that it's ambiguous, the Copyright Office has actually spoken on this direct case here that's before the court today. When my clients submitted their filings with the office, there was a response letter. It's in the record actually, this is the wrong site. I'll get the site on my rebuttal, but it's in the record. And they stated there were three options that the office can do when they get a submission. They can reject it. Two, they can hold on to it and note they actually say their reservations. Or three, they can receive it and process it. And if there were some clear pronouncement by the office here, they would have rejected it, I assume. But instead, they didn't. They received it and they stated some reservations. They stated that they were concerned that they believe that the Internet is not a communications channel. And then they looked to the courts. They said this issue has been raised before the courts. It's been raised before the FCC. So we're going to wait and see what they do. And they did that because there are significant consequences to finding that the Internet is not a communications channel.
But I don't understand. All the letter says is we're going to not throw away your filing. It says we will accept them on a provisional basis.
I'm reading the paragraph before where they describe what they can do. And I'm merely arguing that the fact that they didn't reject it is an indication, again, that they're looking to the courts for guidance here.
Well, we don't. To be fair, I think this letter doesn't help really either side very much, because maybe they're looking to the courts to decide whether they're going to give Chevron deference to their earlier views. It says, for the reasons discussed above, the office does not believe Philmon qualifies for the Section 111 statutory license and will not process Philmon's filings at this time. Then it goes on to say, we understand that this issue is in a court, so we're not going to refuse the filings, but we'll accept them on a provisional basis. That doesn't sound like an inconsistency in their views. That sounds like they're trying to be diplomatic and waiting to see what the court will do. That doesn't really answer this question.
Well, I believe it does answer the question of whether or not there has been a notice and comment rulemaking.
There's clearly been no notice and comment. I don't think anybody thinks there's been a notice and comment rulemaking on this issue, but both the 92 and the 97 rulemakings are both notice and comment rulemakings, and in both of them they say that Congress intended the compulsory license to apply to localized retransmission services. And then it says, and that's the reason why for SMATV we're saying it's okay, and why for satellite we're saying it's not okay, right? So the rationale has been subject to notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, again, Your Honor, I I point your honor to the 2008 FOIA report that I cited earlier, where they recognize that there are national services.
Just to be fair here, that's not a rulemaking. That's a report to Congress. What I'm asking about are the two. There are two actual formal rulemakings, and in both of them, the case turns, the determination of the agency turns on its definition of cable system and of an other communications channel. Right? Isn't that right?
I think that's correct.
And in each case, they define that. Their view is that it has to be an inherently localized transmission media of limited availability. Now, whether that's reasonable or not is yet another question, but that's clearly the rationale they use for making a determination. That's their definition. Without that definition, they could not have made the determination. So why isn't that... However strong the MEAD requirement for a formalized rulemaking is, it's pretty strong on that issue. It doesn't resolve our case. It just tells us what the agency definition is.
I understand the agency's concern, and it also should be recognized, like the district court in California recognized, that the Copyright Office has a mandate to protect copyrights, and that's why it's resisted the compulsory license at every turn. And it's no surprise that every time a new technology comes up, the office resists that technology.
The fact that an agency has policy views can't surprise you. This is like, you know, gambling in Casablanca, really. That's the whole point of having an agency, is to have policy
views. And I appreciate that. I'm simply pointing that out, and therefore I'm not surprised at all, Your Honor. I think it's dangerous, though, to play connect the dots with other rulemakings that aren't directly on point. And so when we take these other rulemakings and extrapolate from them to try to concoct some formal rulemaking here that precludes the Internet from being a communication channel, there are significant consequences that I believe, and I put to the court, that that's why the Copyright Office has not taken a formal position here. And I further will point out the difference between what it did in the satellite cases and what it did here. When it was confronted with satellite, even after the Georgia District Court said, you're not entitled because you don't have a facility that's not in outer space that's retransmitting the signal, this Copyright Office started to act then and there. It started to act. Formal notice rulemaking process begins. That hasn't happened here, in spite of the fact that over a year and a half ago, a court in California said Film on X is or may be entitled to a license. So there are dramatically different facts.
Can I ask what this is not a statutory term, this localized or inherently localized. Does it mean that the facility is in the same locality or region as the broadcasts that it's transmitting? Or does it mean that the customers are in the same locality as the facility?
I believe it's the former. I believe it's the former, Your Honor, and I wish I could point to the case. I just don't remember which case. I've read a lot of cases that defines that concept as essentially within the market where you could receive the signal with an antenna.
Okay. Does Filmon comply with that locality requirement?
Yes.
Okay, so then why aren't you embracing it? Fine, you're happy with that definition of inherently localized.
We will embrace that, in fact.
Customers have to be.
We will embrace that. I'm answering the court's questions, but there's no intention to violate that provision or to transmit signals distantly.
Even whether you accept or not, whether it should be there or whether the Copyright Office gets deference, you contend that you meet that definition of an inherently localized.
Correct. I will point out that there have been past iterations of the Filmon technology that have not complied with that. For instance, the analog to IVI, which was the subject of the first litigation in this sequence.
The record before us, the case.
The record before you, no. There's no intention to transmit outside of the local area. And again, this is an important distinction between this case and IVI and its progeny. IVI stated it had no intention to comply with any FCC rules and regulations, and it was going to transmit nationwide at the same time all the time. That's not what Filmon's doing here. And again, I understand there may be a gray area as to what constitutes a facility, but there was no evidence of any facility in IVI. And IVI was grappling with whether or not the Internet was a facility.
Is the transmitting that you do coming from that same facility that receives the signals?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have servers in there or?
Yes. Yes. So there's a lot of equipment in there, again, that I can't explain. And if there are no further questions, I have some. Okay.
No, you go ahead.
So
okay.
We're not like the other.
I'm trying to respect my friend's time, so.
We're going to take all of their time out of yours, so they're finished.
Then I'll keep talking.
What about their argument that we should construe the statute consistently with free trade agreements and the Berne Convention?
So there are a few points that I would make in response to what I think has been styled the charming Betsy argument here. And first and foremost, this dispute is domestic. And the Sarah V. Lappin case holds
I don't think that matters for charming Betsy necessarily.
Well, I'll just cite the court to Sarah V. Lappin, which actually stated the charming Betsy canon comes into play only where I'm sorry, I cited that wrong. it's a different case. And
the point, I think, is the statute, wherever the activity is taking place, the statute should be construed consistently with international obligations.
Well, so let me start over. I apologize. Sarah V. Lappin finds that it's not necessary where there's no ambiguity. So that's point one. Point two, I know the court wants to hear about if there is ambiguity, so allow me to move on. The Quality King case versus Danza, which I think is a very important case on this point. The Supreme Court found that because these treaties are entered into after the 1976 Act, they provide no guidance and no insight as to the interpretation of the 76 Act. I would also point to Capital Cities v. Crisp, where the court found that anyone who's transmitting over the public airwaves, and these are public airwaves, we're talking about free-to-air television here, this is a public good, that anyone transmitting over those airwaves consents and is subject to the compulsory license. There's also this court's opinion, Your Honor's concurring opinion in the Al-Bahani case.
That's not binding.
Well,
I wish, but no.
Except for its persuasive value.
I would argue that it is persuasive. And in this case, these were not self-effectuating treaties. There has been subsequent congressional action to enact the treaties, but that action has actually, the implementing statutes have actually stated that nothing in these acts shall be construed to amend or modify any U.S. law. So
right,
I think
so you would say the text of the statute specifically addresses this?
Yes.
And the Berne Convention doesn't apply to domestic law by its terms, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you have more, Brett?
No, go ahead.
So here's what I think, for me at least, is the hardest thing with your position. And that is, in 1976, at the exact same time Congress enacted F3, the definition of facility we're wrestling with, over in the transmit clause, they adopted language that I think would be perfect for your situation. There they said, that it's they use to define transmit any device or process now known or later developed. And that exact same year when they were writing that language in the exact same bill, they went over in F3 and used a definition that just inarguably by its words is not does not have that same type of capacious language, especially with respect to forthcoming technologies. How could we give effect to your reading of facility and still honor that textual distinction that Congress must have quite deliberately made?
So I think there's a spectrum, pardon the pun, of legislation here. We have, as Your Honor points out, the transmit clause, which the Supreme Court recently found in Aereo is technology agnostic. We've argued that the Copyright Act should be interpreted as such, but I concede that that language is more broad than what's in the Section 111 F3 compulsory license provision. But then we have to also look at what else is out there, and I point the court to one notch further down the spectrum, and that is the Communications Act, which has significant restrictions, which requires a closed end-to-end transmission path, for example. That's not in the Section 111 F3 requirements. Mm-hmm. And moreover, in NFL v. Insight, it was found that Insight Communications as a passive carrier did not need to own the entire transmission path. So that requirement has been considered by other courts. Again, that's persuasive. It's not the law of this court. But the law, although not as broad as the transmit clause, of the compulsory license is broad such that other communication channels must include something that is made up of the three things that are enumerated: wires, cables, and microwave. And any other reading, or to insert the words, as the district court did, of direct or must be local, must be end-to-end, first of all, those things don't happen today. Every one of the networks that's a plaintiff in this case has its content available on the internet already. And they'll argue that that's subject to licenses, and I don't know. That's not in the record in this case. I don't know what it is, but the parade of horribles that are pointed out about the internet simply don't exist anymore. And it is FilmOnX's intention to transmit only locally. FilmOnX should be a cable system and should be entitled to compete on equal footing with other technologies that at one time needed a lift up. These cable companies were struggling, and so there was some recognition of their investment. FilmOnX has invested significant resources, and it's fighting against now some of the largest companies in the world that are these cable companies that got the benefit of this compulsory license in 1976.
Does the now known or later developed language that does not appear in F3 mean that Congress did not want the definition of cable system to embrace new technologies, to leave it to Congress to deal with it, because it strikes a delicate balance under the Copyright Act?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and I point to the microwave legislation in that when Congress actually said we have to step in here and act because of an overly restrictive and narrow interpretation of other communications channels. Those are the critical words, or other communications, plural, channels, plural.
The microwave was hardly a novel technology at the time, even in 1976. I mean, it was a new application, but microwaves have been around a very long time. So
that's true, Your Honor, but I would say that the internet, again, consists of physical wires, cables, and microwaves. It's simply an assembly of those things that can't somehow deprive it of being a communications channel, because it is, again, an assemblage of the things that have been around for time immemorial. And again, we've also cited in our brief the fact that microwaves, as the Copyright Office was concerned with, weren't necessarily inherently localized, and neither are cables. The transatlantic cable, it goes thousands of miles. So the difference that the plaintiffs try to paint here between the internet, this horrible, unmanageable thing, and wires, cables, and microwave is immaterial in this instance. It's not recognized in the statute, and this court should give meaning to the words of Congress. And I'll reserve whatever time the court will give me.
Just got one more question. We'll give you some time, don't worry. The FCC rules requirement, what about that? It has to be permissible under the FCC rules?
So as the court actually in IVI and the satellite cases recognized, because the FCC is not actively regulating OTT providers such as FilmOn, over-the-top providers such as FilmOn, FilmOn is therefore permissible.
Does the FCC have a rule that says if we haven't directly addressed this, you can do anything you want?
I can't point the court to an FCC rule, but I can point the Copyright Office has taken that position, and the IVI court recognized that position. And
the 11th Circuit do it?
Yes, the 11th Circuit did in the satellite cases as well, Your Honor. And in this instance, in fact, there is in the record, there's an open NPRM at the FCC on this issue. And even as recently as January 17th, the FCC issued another update to its annual reporting of the status of television transmission. And in footnote 23 of that report, it identifies that NPRM, which is still an open item at the FCC. So the FCC is actively considering these issues.
But in the interim, if we were to say that was okay, you could go ahead, you would be the only communications channel that can go ahead without any regulation by the FCC?
Well, Your Honor, I honestly can't speak to whether or not there are others out there that are outside of the FCC's active and current regulation. I'm not enough of an FCC expert. But I can only say I don't believe that to be true, and I don't think that's dispositive in light of what the IVI court and 11th Circuit has recognized. Sorry, Your Honor.
You agree the FCC could regulate FilmOn as a cable service?
I absolutely do, and I've been there with my client urging them to do that, and that's an open item.
Well, would it be as a cable service or as a multimedia distributor? Because you said you don't meet the definition of cable service under the Communication Act.
MVPD is what it would be, and I think certain provisions, again, I'm sort of outside of my league on the FCC-ish side of this, but Film on X, even if it were deemed a cable company under the FCC Act, would comply with the Act in to the extent that it could, because I believe there are some pieces of that would be challenging, but there would be obviously I believe the FCC is considering a new regime that would govern over-the-top providers like Film on.
Okay, thank you. We'll let you go now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Judge Garland, and may it please the court. Before beginning, I'd just like to thank the court and my lovely opposing counsel for agreeing to graciously move this argument by a few hours. Film On now claims that it's a cable system. That claim contradicts the text of the Copyright Act, contradicts its purpose, and contradicts what nearly every judge looking at this question has found. And indeed,
before you dive in, I just had a question about the last footnote in your brief, where you say you still have other arguments as to why they would not qualify as a cable system, including under 111F3, which is a facility provision that we are supposed to be interpreting now. What is your argument that you haven't shared with us about 111F3?
Well, I think I think there's basically four arguments that we're trying to preserve in that footnote. The first is that Film On has been transmitting programs that have been altered, and the Section 111 precludes willful alteration. So Film On's transmitting our programs with logos.
I get that you've got some under the other sections of 111. I'm curious about the F3 one.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one is F3. I'll just give you the four, and so that's one. The other is that Film On has to file semi-annual statements with the Copyright Office. They haven't done that with all stations. That retransmissions also have to be permissible under FCC rules, but there is no FCC rule that's permitting Film On to transmit.
I think your
this.
Position would be, I think, as in one of the amicus, that it's not enough just to have an absence of regulation.
Correct, Your Honor. And their position was just being elucidated, would basically make Film On a unique category of one, subject to no FCC regulations, indeed no government regulation at all. And Congress in 1976, when they enacted the limited provision in Section 111 for compulsory licenses, had something different in mind, kind of making up for the fact that there's must carry an extensive FCC regulation and the like. And I think if you adopt Mr. Baker's form.
Sorry, can we just get back? I haven't heard anything yet that's an F3 argument. You haven't yet. None of those arguments are F3 ones.
They may not be. There might be that there's some technical reason why they're within the scope of F3, but I'm not totally sure. But those are the arguments. Substantive. Oh, I'm sorry. F3 is the paying subscriber provision as well, and that's in the language of F3. And Film On, for at least a time, was transmitting the stuff for free to folks instead of to paying subscribers. And that, by the way, was the one limitation.
On this current record, they don't charge customers?
I'm not sure that it's necessarily in the record, on summary judgment. It's something that we'd certainly preserve and want to elucidate to the extent that we didn't win before this court. But I do think that's a very important point, that Mr. Baker's position allows, as he was saying, a kid in the basement to be a cable system. At that means
if
anything
you have paying
is a
subscriber.
And yes, and
what's wrong with that?
Well, paying subscriber is a separate limitation, and as I was just saying to Judge Millett, I mean, the whole point of Congress in 1976, I think, and this was teed up by Judge Millett's point about the contrast between the broad Section 101 provision, the transmit clause, which does provide to any new process now known or later developed, and
it said other communications channels. So under your theory, it should have said wires and cables.
No, not at all, Your Honor. We do agree that Congress by using the phrase other communications channels intended to pick up technologies that are like wires and cables in 1976.
For example,
fiber optic.
Fiber optic is a cable.
Well, I don't think it quite is a cable. The technical
fiber optic, it looks like a cable.
It looks like a cable, but I do think it's different. You know, and the technical term is optical fiber. And if you look, for example, at Oxford English Dictionary and define cable, it's defined as a thick rope of strands of iron wire. And that's why I think Congress is trying to say, look, we want to limit, we want to restore with the broad 101 provision property rights over turning Fort Knightley and teleprompter, but we do want to provide this compulsory license to folks like wires and cables who have huge capital investments under a regime.
Capital investment for the microwaves, the wireless cables.
There was investment, and that's
what. What huge capital investment was?
Maybe not as huge, but
it's an antenna and receiver.
Yes, but. Again, as the Copyright Office explained, and this is at 56 Federal Register 31584, there were those kinds of equipment investments there. There's nothing by Philmon. Philmon is
why does that matter? That's kind of Congress was trying to solve a specific problem.
Correct.
And as you well know, the Supreme Court has told us many times, don't interpret the words of the statute to be limited by the specific problem they might have been thinking about at the time, but just take the words as written. And here, I think one of the keys to the case for me is trying to figure out what is wires, cables, microwave now, which doesn't help you, and other communications channels. What is the linkage or the trait that links those terms? Localized is not the trait that I think, to my mind, links those terms. So the Copyright Office's interpretation of justum generis doesn't seem to fit here. So your response to all that?
Yes, it's two things. Number one, Your Honor, in order to rule for them, you'd have to say the statute is unambiguous the other way, given deference and Charming Betsy.
How clear does it need to be clear?
But I don't think they come close, and that's why six courts have come out the other way on this particular point. But I agree with you that basically the Supreme Court has taught this court in Circuit City and other cases under the justus generum principle, look to wires, cables, and microwave, and try and figure out what are those underlying characteristics of them.
And localized is not the underlying characteristic.
But I do think it is. So wires and cables certainly aren't. I don't think my friend on the
wires
other side
says. Cables, the underlying characteristic could have been physical. But when they add microwaves, that kind of knocks that out of the picture.
Correct. But again, as the Copyright Office said at that page that I read to you, microwaves are localized as well. It may be localized along a slightly broader transmission path, but it is still a defined transmission path. You know that for those 30 miles of the microwave burst, where it's going. Contrast that to Philmon, which uses the Internet, and a packet on the Internet.
What is the Internet? The Internet, when they say they use the Internet, it's not some other thing. It is. It has a physical structure. They don't just blast it into the air, right? They use cables, wires, microwaves, maybe radio waves. Maybe they aren't all microwaves, but under justum generis, I got to think cable, wires, radio waves sure fits pretty close to cable.
Judge Millett, we don't doubt at all that the Internet uses wires and cables. That's not our argument. Our argument is everything uses those things. And if you accept their interpretation, you are striking the list altogether and giving cables and wires and microwaves and other communications channel no meaning whatsoever. Our brief at page 24 gives you just a visual depiction of this.
I got that. Now, what is your meaning? What is your connection? And what do you think is a communication channel? If you think fiber optics counts as cables, because they call them fiber optic cables, What fits in there?
Something with a defined transmission path that's under the control.
What do you mean by defined transmission?
That you know exactly where it's going. And this is really important, Judge Millett, because, you know, my friend said when he goes to Dulles that he can watch TV or something on his iPad. That's because of negotiated four licenses for content. That's the only way that takes place. And when our clients are negotiating those licenses, one of the most important things, particularly about Internet distribution, is the risk of piracy, is the risk that these packets are going all over the world with the Internet, unlike the 30-mile microwave burst or something like that.
So you want the communication channel to be controlled?
Correct.
The path
of transmission to be controlled.
So the communication channel, the path that microwaves use, is the air.
Correct.
Well, that's not particularly.
But it is a defined path as to which, as the Copyright Office says, The Copyright Office says that they provide specialized equipment that provides the subscribers with the equipment necessary to receive the signals in their homes.
Right, but
and so
I think the specialized equipment now happens to be cables and wires linking my computer at home or my TV at home up to the internet. But you've got, as in the microwave situation, you've got an antenna,
yeah,
air, and a receiver. And what they have is antenna, cables, wires, waves going through the air, and a receiver. And I'm just not having, I'm not understanding. I think you both have problems. We all have problems with this text.
Our position is not, just to be clear, that you have to read the text our way. We certainly agree. Could you read microwave that way and read other communications channel that way? Is there an argument? Yes, there's an argument. We don't think it's the best reading. And I think the best way of understanding this judgment.
Microwave what way? How are you reading microwave differently from how I read microwave?
Well, I think microwave does have a defined transmission path, unlike the internet, which is international. And as I was saying, that has huge implications for folks like our clients. I think the best way of understanding why our textual argument is better than theirs is to focus on the fact of what Congress did. This was Judge Kavanaugh's question before about satellites. Because when satellites came around, which does look very much like the internet, a kind of global distribution system or something like that, Congress passed two separate standalone statutes, this is what Judge Collier said as well, to deal with that. They didn't add this and jam it in to section.
No, I know, because they didn't have a facility here on Earth, which Philmon does. But I guess what I'm trying, they say that they've got a controlled path that keeps it from going to others, and I understand you all have concerns about that. If their claim that they have a way of controlling and limiting when it leaves their antenna and goes through cables and wires, and at some point it hits some either micro or radio waves. If there's a, is there a disputed fact about whether this is controlled?
Oh, absolutely. There's a disputed fact. I mean, this is just their say-so, Your Honor. I mean, this is.
Then why are we here?
Because our position is that it's got to be inherently localized, not that you can add some technology to make it localized.
Where do those words come from?
Well, they come from, as you were saying, Your Honor, before, the Copyright Office has had that determination since 1992, and we think it's just like wires and cables in a justum generis.
What does inherently localized mean? In a circumstance in which the only person who can receive this is somebody who is paid. That is, not anyone on the internet can receive it. You have to have an IP address that is the one that pays for this subscription. They say that they can also geolocate this. Now, imagine we were to hold that an internet delivered system which has guaranteed geolocation and guaranteed subscriber definition is okay, but if this is not that system, it's not okay, and those are facts that have to be determined. And if they, for example, violated that or were unable to do that, they would be infringing.
Right.
No, just take that as the hypothetical. The hypothetical is they actually can geolocate, and they can also guarantee that only a subscriber gets the transmission.
Right. I think that that isn't enough because Congress had in mind inherently localized, not some technology that could be added on after the fact. Wires and cables are inherently localized, and that the path of transmission from one end to the other is always under the control of the facility.
Always under control and inherently localized?
They are always under control. So my friend on the other side was pointing to AT&T, for example, using IP and Verizon, which is absolutely wrong. That when it uses IP, in those examples, it's IP the language, not IP the internet protocol for transmission.
It's microwave inherently localized.
Well, as the Copyright Office said, it's localized in the sense that it's, you know, a defined path of about 30 miles. It's not the internet, and that's
why microwaves can go much longer than 30 miles.
You can string them together and stuff like that, but still, it is a defined transmission path. You know, when the microwave burst happens, basically the axis.
Is it a narrow beam that only hits your house, or does it?
Well, I don't think it's that narrow, but you know, but it is a very big difference from the internet, which is international packets.
But fine, the only thing that guarantees that a subscriber is the one who gets it is some kind of de-encrypting device, right?
For a microwave?
For a microwave, yeah.
I assume that's right. I mean, well, I should say two things. One is that's right in that it's the decryption technology, but also the just the physical limitations of the spectrum, so that, you know, you have to be fairly near the microwave to be able to pick up the signal.
Still, there could be in a city, there could be millions of people. In a rural area, there might be fewer. It just depends on how many people are within the.
But I think the whole point of Section 111 is to focus narrowly on narrow geographies. There's all sorts of language in 111 about communities, about distance
That's
signals.
In the other sentence, though.
It's all through, though. I think it's, you know, head ends. You know, I think all of this 111 is really getting
at. Here's, I just want you to respond to this. So, cable system, if it hadn't been defined in the statute, I would think inherently localized makes some sense as a instinct, and so if the Copyright Office had defined it. But the problem for you, and I want you to address, is that Congress did define what cable system is in a way that's broader, perhaps, than what my instinct would have been about what a cable system is by using these broad phrases, including other communications channels. And so I think the Copyright Office, it's inherently localized, really goes to cable system what we instinctively think, not to, at least in my judgment, I'm worried about, not to the defined terms that Congress has put in for what a cable system is.
So Judge Kavanaugh, that's interesting. I would think it cuts exactly the other way. That is, if you accept their interpretation, you're effectively gutting cable system of anything. Everything is a cable system then.
Congress, arguably, if the text means what they say, did that. And so the microwave example is a good one in some sense, because the Copyright Office says no, and Congress comes back and says yes. And I don't put too much credence on this, but the House and Senate reports do say, hey, the Copyright Office, in our judgment of those committees, was wrong to so narrowly confine the statutory terms.
Well, but they don't overrule the Copyright Office's longstanding definition, which is inherently localized. And I think, you know, the contrast between 101, which would do the kind of work that you're saying about any device and process, and the much more limited terms, wires and cables, in the statutes, underscored by the fact that Congress, when they're confronted with new technologies, every time has created standalone legislation, satellites, microwaves, and the like.
I mean, that's why this is a, you know, great statutory interpretation case.
Agreed.
Is it a statute where Congress meant to freeze it in time and to update it when new technologies came along, or was it a statute where Congress gave that open-ended terminology that would encompass the known unknowns?
And I would say we have three textual clues that say it's really the latter in our favor. One is the fact that they use these technology-specific words, wires, cables, microwave, unlike the language in 101. So I do think that that suggests a kind of technology-specific limitation. Two, if you adopt their interpretation, it effectively means anything is a communications channel. And three, you have
Not the mail, for example.
Excuse me?
Not the mail.
Not the mail, but anything that transmits a signal. Mail doesn't transmit a signal, but you know, the kid in the basement. And that would radically reshape the entire nature of broadcast TV in this country, something I don't think Congress had in mind.
I think Congress thought back then that kids in the basement could transmit things for subscription. I think they thought the for subscription was going to ensure that it was serious.
Quite agree, Judge Millett, but I think that point cuts in our favor. As Judge Collier found at page 39 of her opinion, Congress has picked up and tinkered with Section 111 time and again, in this very statute, including very recently, four times in the last decade, but they've never...
In the sense of Congress has tinkered with it because the Copyright Office has consistently been interpreting it too narrowly. I mean, you can argue it both
ways. They've never
ways.
Put inherently localized in. They haven't done that, even though they've been told to do it.
The Copyright Office has said very clearly and consistently, Judge Buchwald goes through this in a lot of detail, as well as Judge Collier, always, that internet-based transmissions don't qualify. Whether or not it's notice and rulemaking, you know, is a different matter. But
Aereo, and I'm not going to draw too much significance from this again, but there are, by my count, seven times where the opinion, put aside the oral argument, where the opinion says the activities are substantially similar to cable, overwhelming likeness for all practical purposes, a traditional cable system, many similarities. Why should any of the technological differences matter? Highly similar to cable. You know, that Aereo, and that's just the court looking at the statute, looking at the technology and saying, looks like a cable.
Yeah, I'll answer that, and then I'd like to go back to the third reason in response to your last question. But so I think, as Judge Collier said, that's an absolute overreading of the decision. They certainly looked at the statute, but what part of the statute were they looking at? Judge Millett's Section 101, the broad transmit clause. The whole point of Congress in 76 was to restore broad property rights protections and then a narrow exception for cable systems and compulsory licenses. And that's underscored by the fact that Aereo itself, it put footnote 17 of its brief to the Supreme Court, disclaimed any idea that there are Section 111 cable system. By the way, Philmon also disclaimed that as well, as Judge Collier points out.
They're going for the best argument, now they're going for the second best.
But I'm just pointing out that, well, it's not just they're going for the second best, it was disclaimed before, and certainly was disclaimed in Aereo.
So, jus in generis, as you quoted, says the words have to be similar. And as Judge Kavanaugh said, the Supreme Court said five times, at least by his count, that it was similar to a cable system. And what we're trying to do is interpret a definition of, quote, cable system. Those are the words we're trying to interpret.
Right.
So under that theory, why I don't see why jus in generis doesn't get.
Because, for Section 111, Congress had a technology-specific idea in mind. That's the enumeration of wires, cables, microwaves, and stuff like that.
That's the answer to the question that we're trying to answer.
I don't think so. I think what it suggests is that it is that they're focused on specific technologies, and then the question is, what are the underlying characteristics of those technologies? And is
ad or other communication channels.
In the same way as, for example, in Circuit City, you know, the statute there, which covers seamen, longshoremen, and other workers, you know, the reason why it added other workers is any other workers, by the way, in that statute, is because they said other workers that are like transportation workers. Here again, like fiber optic or other things like that.
These are other things
that bear the
communication. In the other statute, it was other workers in international or interstate commerce, which is the important additional words that you're leaving out in that statutory definition. And here, we're looking at other communications channels, and we know that wires, cables, microwaves are methods of communication. So what we're looking for is something that enables communication.
Chief Judge Garland, I do think you could read the statute that way, but I think to read it that way is to defy everything we know about what Congress was doing in 1976. And, you know, if you read just the reply brief, you might be left with the impression that Congress was trying to enable compulsory licenses for all sorts of other communications channels, but there's just nothing to support that. Rather, what Congress was trying to do was restore property rights protections for small mom-and-pop to the copyright holders, and then to have a narrow exception for small mom-and-pop cable systems that engage in huge sunk costs.
On either side here, this is the problem. There's no clear indication of legislative history, I don't think, either way. And certainly I don't see anything that establishes your position. I understand you could construct it from the course of events, but it's not usually the way we try to figure out what the text means.
I do think that there's a lot in the legislative history about the fact that the cable industry at the time was pervasively regulated, including must-carry regulations, and that folks like Philmon who argue that they don't have to comply with any of it, that's really different. Congress was not, in 1976, granting compulsory licenses to any communications.
So you think pervasively regulated is the question?
I do think that's part of
not the other thing.
I do think that's part of what Congress had in mind. So when you're again,
if the FCC were to start trying to regulate this, you would say, well, they can't because it's not a cable system, and we're going to go round and round in a circle.
Well, I think, you know, to the extent the FCC does, and as I understand the last thing they've said, they've disclaimed the idea that they're going to continue with any sort of rules. And I think you deal with that case then, but I think it would make it a closer case than what you have right now, which is
it's quite different. Element than we've heard before. This is
it's an additional one.
How does it apply to microwaves? The microwave, the wireless broadcasters, they don't have must carry.
Yeah, I think it's complicated with microwaves. Some parts of microwave aspects do and some don't. But again, there Congress added that specific technology to the list, as Judge Collier said. That's really the way Congress deals with this problem, either for satellites and microwaves.
You got it wrong, copyright office. They don't say, wow, We never thought of that. You were right, Copyright Office, but now that we think about it, let's put them in, even though they aren't inherently regulated and subject to these MOOCs.
But Judge Millett, what's the it that Congress said they got wrong? They got wrong the it of the microwave. That is, that Congress never overruled the Copyright Office's longstanding determination that Section 111 is limited to inherently localized transmission media of limited...
2008 report where they said that the AT&T U-verse, which is a national cable system, is permissible as a facility under 111F3 because the term cable system is meant to be read quite broadly, in their words. That seems very different.
So I do think that my friend on the other side hasn't totally read to you all of that report. So first of all, page 5 of that Shavira report says, quote, Verizon has built a fiber to the premises physical plant. That's in the report. Okay. Yeah, so... And it's certainly the case that Verizon has a national cable system, but the fact is that cable is still inherently localized. That is the transmission path Verizon is using from one end to...
199, they say, first we have to interpret cable system, in their words, quite broadly. The issue here is whether AT&T and Verizon each operate a single national cable system, and they have national IP-based systems, and they go, but... That works for us. It's a facility under 111F3.
Correct. And there's other parts of that report that specifically say, the Copyright Office specifically says they don't think internet-based transmission technologies are eligible for 111 license. Why? Because they say that that unlike that national cable system, it is national. It's not local, but the technical term and the thing that the Copyright Office cares about is inherently localized, not local. And
this phrase keeps coming up a lot. Yeah. And I don't. Do you mean by inherently localized that the facility is picking up the local broadcast transmissions and sending them out, and the customers have to be in that same jurisdiction?
Well, we do think that the transmission path, no, it's just the transmission path has to be something that is controlled by the facility, exactly. And so, you know, this is something you'd ask.
But no.
That's different than localized, because it could be over the whole country and you could control the wire.
I think, you know, for purposes of, you know, your question about make and facility, the argument there that Judge Collier was getting at is that Congress didn't use the word send. Use the word make, and so if I send
make a transmission to, so
correct.
Transmission is send.
Correct. Well, I don't think it's send. I think there's a difference between send and make. So, I mean, if I send you flowers, then I could have someone else send you the flowers. But if I, make a delivery of flowers,
well, they make a transmission. You could make a transmission to me without doing it yourself.
Well, I think it's possible, again, to read it that way, but I think the best...
I think it's a very natural reading of transmission.
Well, I think make does signify personal completion in a way that send doesn't, and that's why the make a delivery...
You have to own the wires?
Well, I think you have to control the wires. I mean...
What do you mean by control?
I think you have to, lease or, understand that defined transmission path, and again, that's...
Why I understand the point about... guaranteeing the destination, but you do that by the headers on your packets.
It's not just guaranteeing destination. It's the entire path.
Yes, and this I is what understand that's what a judge said, but I don't see that in anything that even the copyright.
I think the Copyright Office has said, for example, in 2000 in the Peters testimony, that they're very worried about internet-based transmission services because of the risk of piracy. And as I was saying before to Judge Millett, every time one of our clients negotiates one of those licenses for internet TV, one of the most extensive things that takes place is precisely this question about how to guard against taking the signal, disruption of the signal in the packets, and piracy of
that.
That's
a good policy argument, but it doesn't, I don't see how it's fits into the language of this statute.
Well, again, if you're trying to understand what cables, wires, and microwave means, I think one way of understanding it is to say that these are all limited transmission media, localized, where the risk of piracy is not as great.
This is the problem with this canon, the Houston Generous canon. It forces judges to make up a linkage, and I'm not criticizing you because we have the canon. But do you agree the internet is a communications channel?
Well, it is colloquially a communications channel. We just don't think it is for purposes of, you know, of Section 111. To read it that way is to effectively gut and strike that list of any meaning whatsoever.
But it is a communications channel.
Colloquially speaking, just as workers were, you know, someone, a Circuit City employee was a worker in the Circuit City case, but not a worker for purposes of the statute there. And if I could, I'd like to return.
The Supreme Court's also said, and I know they have the cases like Circuit City, but the whole value, this is Iraq versus Beatty, the whole value of a generally phrased residual clause like the one used here is that it serves as a catch-all for matters not specifically contemplated, known unknowns in the happy phrase coined by the Secretary of Defense. If Congress wanted to limit the waiver authority to particular statutes that it had in mind, it could have enumerated them individually. So too here, they could have said cables and wires.
They could have, but I think the textually we have a very good clue that Congress wanted to limit it because of the contrast to 101. Congress knew exactly how to write a statute that did what Philemon wants. They did so in the transmit clause.
I really can't think. I'm trying to put myself in the mind of a member of Congress in 1975, and you know the problem, and you know it's cables and wires, and then someone says, well, let's add in just these few other words, other communications channel. That's a huge door that you're opening to who knows what in the future, potentially.
I don't think it's a huge door, Your Honor, because it's in the defined term of cable system. That's what the title of the statute is. That's what Section 111D is, cable systems. And the idea that Congress was opening the door to, you know, particularly given their stated policy concerns about pervasive regulation.
Why create the risk? If you're a member of Congress in 1976, why create the risk of future expansion? Why not just say, we want wires and cables? We know the problem in front of us. It's cable systems, as we instinctively think of them. And so we'll put wires and cables in here. Or why define it at all?
Because I assume they thought, you know, other things might come along, like fiber optic, which are by cable systems.
Like fiber optic, you're adding in. But I agree with the first part of what you said. I think they thought other things might come along.
But did they intend to actually undo the definition altogether, which is what theirs would do? I think that's hard. And we know this because Congress, every time there's new technologies, satellites and microwaves, three times have enacted standalone legislation to deal or added to the list specifically to deal with it. They haven't done what Philemon is asking this court to do, which is jam in internet-based distribution technologies to this Section 111 definition. Now, I'd said a long time ago that I'd love to return to the third point. Can I please do that?
Still got a note
okay.
to that.
Thank you. The third point is the Charming Betsy canon, something you'd ask my others, you know, my friends on the other side about. And we do think, again, that's a separate tiebreaker. We haven't yet really talked about administrative deference, which I'd like to do as well. But, you know, that's a canon that says that, you know, if this court is going to interpret a statute that would put it in violation of the laws of nations or of treaties, then that is a factor counseling against it. We're not saying it's, you know, an absolute 100.
Law of nations. There's no treaty. What law of nations would be violated here? Law of nations had a very specialized meaning back at the time Chief Justice Marshall.
Your Honor, there are treaties. There are nine separate treaties at issue. So if I think your question is, how does it apply to, how does the Charming Betsy canon apply to treaties? Is that the?
No, my question is, so what treaties, not bilateral trade agreements?
They're
violated.
There are nine free trade agreements that have been.
Those are not the same as treaties.
Okay, so they're free trade agreements that have been.
Specialized meaning when the Chief Justice Marshall used it. But, in Charming Betsy, correct?
Well, I think Charming Betsy actually just used the word law of nations.
Law
it doesn't
of
use treaties.
Even more specialized meaning.
But the Supreme
the restatement's broadened that, I think.
Okay, and the Supreme Court twice, Judge Millett, this is in Weinberger versus Rossi and in Weimar versus Skyrafer, applied this Charming Betsy canon to international agreements. And so it definitely applies under
bilateral
Supreme Court
free trade agreements?
The first one, certainly Weinberger, is about 12 bilateral agreements. Not necessarily free trade, but I don't think that matters.
But then the Supreme Court, of course, didn't do that in the copyright case, Quality King copyright case.
Well, you know, I think there were other things going on in that case, but I think,
what
you know,
what was going on in that case?
I can't remember the facts of that. I don't think, you know, my friend on the other side cited it, but I don't think it's, you know, I think here you've got the Copyright Office saying that if you adopt this interpretation of Philemon, it would put us out of compliance with nine free.
That's not the Copyright Office's specialty, right? Because you have bilateral trade agreements here that had to have implementing legislation to have any force at all, and the implementing legislation, unless I'm wrong, omitted the provision about internet retransmissions that was in the trade agreement. So there is nothing in what Congress enacted that carried forward that language. So I'm having trouble understanding, first of all, how we know those things were articulating the law of nations, and two, if Congress did not include them in the implementing legislation, what on earth authority do we have to give it effect?
First of all, I think that the international agreements, and a brief explains this, were ones that President Bush, when he signed them, said would not require any changes to legislation, that we're already in compliance with this, including the internet-based transmission provisions. And then Congress enacted that very statement as part of its legislative package. Our brief goes into some detail.
So I'm asking you about something very specifically that happened. If I've got it wrong, please tell me. My understanding is the implementing legislation, right? The president proposes it. The president just proposed it, wrote it up, and it omitted the provision that was in the agreements that talked about limiting or prohibiting internet retransmission. So that did not get put into the implementing legislation. Am I wrong?
My friend on the other side hasn't pointed that out, and I don't recall seeing that anywhere. It might be that's true, but as our brief points out, separately from that, the president said and Congress enacted that very statement that no change to the legislation was necessary because we're already doing that right now, and that was an enactment by Congress.
But each of the statutes also has a provision that purports to abrogate any provision that violates U.S. law. It's kind of an I would call it an anti-Charming Betsy clause.
Well, I don't know if it's an anti-Charming Betsy. Yeah, I think that is overreading. I think that just highlights the fact that courts shouldn't, to read something to put us out of compliance with our international agreements.
I think it was saying don't read the treaty to cause any change to U.S. laws you would otherwise interpret it.
Well, I don't think that's what it says, and I think the only precedent we have on this is Allegheny-Ludlum versus United States, a Federal Circuit decision from 2004 looking at a very similar anti-abrogation clause and saying, don't read it that way. Rather, read it as a Congress underscoring, please don't put us out of compliance with our international agreements.
I think they also say that they can't be used as a defense. And to the extent you're defending against a counterclaim, then the provisions themselves say that the provisions of the agreement are not meant to create any legal defense. So how does that then allow you to still assert Charming Betsy as a defense to their counterclaim?
I don't know that the agreement is that specific on such things, but anyway, we're plaintiffs, so this isn't a counterclaim. This is our affirmative lawsuit, so I don't know that
we're here on a certified 54B counterclaim, disposition of a counterclaim.
It's our affirmative lawsuit seeking an injunction to stop Philmon from proceeding. So I don't think it's a counterclaim, and I think it would be a very weird thing to say that this court should put our country out of compliance with these free trade agreements based on the procedural posture under which something is arising. The other tiebreaker,
court, correct me if I'm wrong, has never applied Charming Betsy where it's a later in time non-self-executing agreement.
So I don't know if there is a precedent. I don't know that they've ruled it out one way or the other. I'm not sure there's a precedent one way.
It's a gerrymandered way to look at it, not appropriate, but I think that's correct. So this would be...
Well, again, we're just saying it's a tiebreaker rule here. My friend cited the Quality King case on the other side for this proposition,
I'm going to question the use of that term because you're saying that actually, even if our reading's not the best, so long as it's ambiguous, we win. So it's not just a tiebreaker. You're saying even if your position is 35%, we win based on Charming Betsy. So when you say it's just a tiebreaker, actually it could be a big deal in the sense of pushing you from losing the case to winning the case.
Well, I sure hope not. I think we should win on other reasons well. But I guess I'd say...
Your position, correct me if I'm wrong, is even if
we think that's true,
best rating, so long as it's ambiguous, we still...
We think that's true for Chevron and the presumption against compulsory licenses, the other two doctrines that are, tiebreakers plus. But I do think Charming Betsy is a softer canon. We're not here saying, and I think your concurrence in Albihani kind of gets at this, we're not trying to say this is... Yeah. So
on presumption against compulsory licensing,
Correct. So,
where does that come from?
Well, I think there's a longstanding tradition in statutory interpretation that exceptions should be read, construed narrowly, and broad grants construed broadly, and that's something that specifically applied in the copyright law itself. And so, that's something that's one doctrine, and then the other one, which we haven't gotten to yet, but is really important, is deference, because as Chief Judge Garland was saying, the Copyright Office twice.
I do with the fact that the Copyright Office said to construe cable system broadly in 2008, in its 2008 report?
Well, I don't think they've ever said anything about construing cable systems to include internet-based transmission technologies.
Out their language to construe cable system broadly in the context of a national system that's at least using internet protocols and
That is totally misunderstanding what inner IP is about. And this Judge Collier.
They were wrong, or we can say IP is very broad, narrow there, but they just said Section 111F defines cable system quite broadly. That was their predicate before going into that. You disagree with that?
I don't disagree with that. It's just that as you then read the report, it says internet-based transmission technologies as opposed to IP, the language, do not qualify.
I get that distinction. I'm just, because I thought we were talking now about, apart from that specific provision, the background rule of statutory construction.
I think you're
here
saying construe the broad language narrowly, which is not I'm not
correct.
Facetiously.
No, that's exactly right. That I think Congress in 1976 said we're going to restore broad property rights protections, and then there's a narrow exception for cable systems. And yes, once you're a cable system, you get a lot of, you get this compulsory license, a complete exception from market-based principles. I mean, that's a huge thing you get. But as the Copyright Office said in 2008, they said it in 2000, they said it in 1991 in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, in 1992 and 1997 in formalized rulemakings, that what Section 111 provides is only only compulsory licenses for inherently localized transmission media of limited availability. And however you construe the internet, it's not that.
Why should we construe this section narrowly? I guess I'm going to challenge that premise, because why not just construe it as written, as opposed to construing it narrowly? I mean, I'm thinking of each of these, as you call them, tiebreakers. Like, what if this decided the case? Okay, the presumption against compulsory licensing seems to come out of thin air. It sounds good, but I don't see it in any law. And why construe it narrowly? Why not just construe it as written?
Well, because I think that the normally when you're interpreting a statute, you interpret the grant broadly and the exception narrowly, particularly when it's something like this, which is a deviation from property rights principles. So this is, this is an unusual thing. Indeed, this is the only compulsory license in the entire code for audiovisual works when it's enacted in 1976. So this is a really unique thing. And then the question would be,
The Copyright Act, the copyright law is very much a balance, a give here and a give here. So
correct.
How do we know this is an exception as opposed to this is, you get this, but this is all you get because these folks are being given this.
Judge Millett, that's exactly our point, that Congress in 76 balanced these things and said, look, cable systems, you've been operating under the teleprompter and fortnightly regime in which you thought you were able to do all of this, and so you've made all of these investments because of this, and now we're switching the rules on you and with the broad transmit clause of Section 101. And so to deal with that problem, Congress enacted that exception. That's what the legislative history is about. And every time subsequently, a new technology.
How do we know to call it an exception, which seems to be quite critical, as opposed to a grant?
Well, because it's an exception to the transmit clause.
You're
the broad language
is a baseline of property rights, mm-hmm. which I agree with, perhaps as a matter of policy, but I'm not sure the statute's all about.
But that is Congress's whole goal in the 76 Act, is to do exactly that, is to restore broad property rights after those two Supreme Court decisions. And so instead of trying to, instead of providing some balance, Judge Millett, that allowed any system to operate, they defined it narrowly as wires and cables and other communications channels. And again, I think you could possibly read it the other way, but that isn't the way the Copyright Office has read it for now more than two decades, including in that 2008 report,
so on the Copyright Office, because you want to get to that, I know.
Thank you.
So let's talk about that. Yeah. I think Judge Millett does too, which is why should we treat these interpretations as authoritative Mead-like interpretations?
Well, I'll start with the fact, as Chief Judge Garland said, you know, you do have in 1992 and 1997 the definition adopted after formal notice and comment rulemaking. And once you have that definition of inherently localized, I think it's just merely ministerial to apply that definition to internet-based transmission technologies.
Usually, perhaps not always, but usually, as you know, the regulation would be in a regulation, or the statement would be in a regulation that then could be challenged by someone with standing at the time the regulation's issued. Here, it seems to be drive-by in a different issue than the issue presented before us. So respond to that.
Yeah, I don't think this is anything like drive-by. I mean, this is the subject of immense debate. I mean, you know, this is, you know, huge amounts of hearings. This is about TV over the internet. This is not the Midnight Judges Act. I mean, this is as, you know, kind of popularly salient as one could get. And there were, as Judge Millett was saying, all sorts of congressional reports. The Copyright Office has been very clear from start to finish, including the 2014 letter that Chief Judge Garland was looking at, which is page 157 of the appendix. And I'd point you to the paragraph before the one that everyone was reading, which says, you know, in no uncertain terms, in the view of the Copyright Office, such a service falls outside the scope of the Section 111 license. In IVI, the Second Circuit deferred and agreed with the office's interpretation of Section 111. We don't see anything in the Supreme Court's recent Aereo decision that would alter this conclusion, and on and on. I mean, this
usually,
has been,
again, not always, but usually the agency would put out a regulation that says the term cable system for purposes of this statute means the following. And then people would know, it would be out there in the CFR, could be challenged. And that's not how this one was done. And your point, I guess, is that shouldn't matter for Chevron purposes. And Mead purposes, because it's still preceded by notice and comment.
Correct. And I think there's just no argument that this is something that wasn't, like, that snuck by in the night or something like that. This is the most, you know.
Well, it gets to what Mead's trying to get at, which I don't know the answer to that.
Really. Yeah, but I do think, as Chief Judge Garland says, one of the things Chevron deference is trying to get at is agency expertise. And here, this agency is vested with this power. Judge Silberman's opinion in MPA versus Cablevision about this very statute, Section 111, says you give Chevron deference to the Copyright Office. And here, they've said this in formal rules twice and lots of times in all sorts of other things, including testimony. So I don't think anyone is under the illusion that the Copyright Office thinks internet-based transmission technologies don't qualify for the Section 111 license.
Slightly stronger argument response to Judge Kavanaugh, though not on the subject of the internet. So it's true that the definition isn't in the regulation, but in explaining why they're adopting the regulation, they base it, that is both the SMATV and the satellite one, on this definition. They give their definition, and therefore this one is, therefore this one isn't. And actually, in the regulation from MMDS, it says they're not eligible for the cable compulsory license based upon an interpretation of the whole of Section 111. So if somebody thought that they had a disagreement with that definition, they could do it. They could have appealed at that point. Now, they couldn't have appealed the internet question because that was not decided by regulation.
Well, I'm not sure if they could or couldn't but I don't know that deference turns on whether or not someone could appeal the regulation. I think, you know, Chevron deference is given because of agency expertise and accountability. Both of those things are true here. And, you know, this brings up a different canon, one that Judge Collier pointed out at page 39, which is a legislative acquiescence.
Has to have the force of law, and there isn't a definition out there that has the force of law in the sense of being adopted in a regulation.
Well, I do think that it does govern, for example, whether or not the Copyright Office will take these submissions that, you know, and count those submissions.
That's like any other agency guidance that the agency itself follows, but it's not something that the Mead term force of law, it's not there.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't know that it's enough. You know, Mead and Barnhart are you know, a little more expansive than just providing Chevron deference there. What I was saying about legislative acquiescence is a separate but important point. Judge Collier at page 39 said, Congress has reenacted the statute, tinkered with it in other ways, but has never changed the Copyright Office's longstanding definition.
I really reject relying on congressional inaction in this circumstance or generally, because we don't know why they did not act. We know they also didn't act in 1999 to adopt your position. I mean, I wouldn't use that against you. I don't think we can use congressional inaction in any way. We just don't know. It's hard to pass a matter of basic separation of powers. It's hard to pass legislation. Congress not acting is not the same as Congress acting.
But it's not just about congressional inaction. It's congressional inaction in the teeth of an administrative interpretation. So this court's decision in Bolden versus Blue Cross, and there have been a whole bunch of other decisions, some that Chief Judge Garland has been on.
That doesn't mean
as well.
The majority of both houses approved of the Copyright Office.
Well, I do think but I do think, as Bolden says, it's at least, you know, it's at least a thumb on the scale to the extent you're trying to decide what does a statute mean. The fact that Congress has tinkered with the statute but has left that part of the statute, that part of the administrative interpretation intact, is important evidence.
Well, if we're going to rely on that, shouldn't we rely on the fact that in 1999 they considered but did not enact a proposal that would have adopted your position?
No, because that's just a mere congressional inaction doctrine. And what I'm saying, Judge Kavanaugh, is this is different because this is something in which the Copyright Office has clearly said, hey, internet doesn't qualify. The definition of 111 is inherently
that's
localized.
A huge grant of authority to the executive branch. Huge, which is you can do any crazy thing you want, executive branch. And if Congress doesn't overrule it, you can call it congressional acquiescence. That is a huge.
I'm not saying that, Judge Kavanaugh. I'm saying
that is what you just said.
No.
Congress is presented with an interpretation, and they tinker with other parts, but they don't tinker with this part. Then that becomes law.
It, you know, and I think you've even written about this once. You've said, you know, if it's something that, you know, Congress didn't know about or something, you know, that's one thing. But this is a unique circumstance. This is one in which the administrative interpretation is obvious, consistent, and known to people in Congress, you know, the subject of Senator Hatch and other people talking about it in the hearing. And then they alter this very provision, 111.
You have 41 senators who you can get to agree with the agency. You can block everything. And that's not how we are not supposed to then defer to 41 senators and treat that as if it's a majority of the House, majority of the Senate, and the president.
No, I completely understand that. But I do think, again, in this court has said it several times, including in the Blue Cross case, including in National Customs and Women Involved, that this is a thumb on the scale when you're trying to interpret a statute. Finally, if on deference, I would say, even if you think that we're wrong on Chevron deference, as Judge Collier found, then that would just put you back into Skidmore deference. And here, the agency has been consistent. It has been thorough. And there are all sorts of policy reasons that underlie its judgments about disrupting markets.
Deference, whatever the level of deference, and it's to the phrase inherently localized, right? That's what you want?
Correct.
And your position is that they are not inherently, tell me how they are not inherently localized as a technological matter in a way that distinguishes them from microwave transmitters.
Because when they transmit, and this was my friend Mr. Baker was saying, facility transmits, what they call a facility, it is sending packets of information not along a control distribution path, but literally across the entire globe.
Control is very different from inherently localized.
No, I do think it's the same thing. It's very hard to say the internet is inherently localized. That is the path of transmission.
The internet is inherently localized. We need to say that their transmission path, under your theory, if we
yes.
need to do it, is inherently localized, which means controlled.
Inherently localized transmission media of limited availability. The internet
well,
is not.
Two different arguments there, just to, so I'm clear mm-hmm. on this. I thought you had an inherently localized argument and a control argument.
Yes, that's true.
Okay,
but
all the Copyright Office has adopted so far is inherently localized, and then
transmission media, and
right.
the internet is not inherently localized transmission media.
I don't have to side the internet as a whole. How is what they're doing technologically not inherently localized?
Because it is the opposite. When they hit send, the packets of information, the transmission media, are the internet, which means that it could be Russia.
Maybe this is a fact dispute in this case, but as they say it, it's not shooting into the air. It's going through cables. Their packets have IP addresses on them that tell them where to go and where not to go.
The cables, and I think this is what Mr. Baker said to you, is that the cables that they use are before it hits the internet. Once it hits the internet,
the internet is not has a physical structure itself, and that is cables, wires, and microwaves.
Judge Millett, everything has a physical structure at some level, so that can't be what Congress was getting at.
I'm trying to get you to pin down what it is. How does it get from that building where they've hit the send button to, imagine I'm 6 blocks away in the same town that they're in. How does it get to me? It goes through cables, right, or wires from that building to my computer, maybe some radio waves or microwaves. That's physically how it gets there. And because of the IP address, it's coming, and their encryption, it's coming to me, and no one else can get it.
It is still not inherently localized transmission media. That is to say, when they hit send, initially, you know, there may be wires in their house, so the laptop connects to a wire, so that's using a wire to send it to a router. Once the router hits it and sends it out as packets of information, those packets of information are transmitted not locally, but nationally, indeed internationally. That is how the internet works. That's why it's not an inherently localized transmission media. And so, for example, a hacker in Russia could
microwaves
go into the air along a localized distribution path. It's a small burst. It is not, you know, someone in Russia cannot get intercept a microwave signal and get live TV. But their technology, the internet, it's not their technology, that's one of our other points. It's, you know, the internet. They didn't pay for it.
Should it matter, I guess, that it takes a long and winding road to the same destination?
It's not about length. It is, again, about inherently localized. That is it a transmission?
Here to here, and one's going directly and one's getting there in the same amount of time or even quicker, but going all over the place before it gets there and getting broken up, I guess, before it gets there too. But why should that matter?
Well, again, I think that one of the animating concerns that the Copyright Office has had is that once you have transmission media that are not localized, it could be anywhere, that's vulnerable to interception and things like that. And as I was saying, when our clients have these bargain for licenses, that's one of the key elements of the negotiations, is to make sure that the signal is preserved. And
Cablevision's unable to be broken into, or is AT&T UVerse unable to be broken into?
Again, it'd be broken into at a specific defined point, and that's different. Excuse me?
AT&T
UVerse. Yeah, and so those things, again, negotiated for licenses with all sorts of, you know, specific content protection in there.
AT&T UVerse hasn't taken its compulsory license that copyright said it gets in 2008. It's negotiated licenses instead?
I think, as I understand it, that AT&T is also subject to, is using licenses. And to the extent they use IP, it's...
Cable company... provides you access on a tablet or a mobile device in addition to your home. You're saying that the in your home part is the statutory license and the to your mobile device is a paid for license, individually negotiated?
It is individually negotiated, yes. So, yes, exactly.
They negotiate a separate license to go to the phone or the iPad.
Yeah, and indeed, if you travel, you know, these are all the subject of all sorts of negotiated licenses that take place.
I think prior oral arguments in your brief have referred to the Brown and Williamson principle, elephants and mouse holes principle. That usually applies when it's a major question. Do you think this is the kind of major question that triggers that
I very much do, Judge Kavanaugh. And again, this goes back to that whole exception versus, you know, construe exceptions narrowly, particularly for compulsory licenses. I think, you know, the idea that Congress in this term, you know, other communications channels intended to do something as dramatic as reshape, you know, television, you know, in this way is, I think, you know, not the way that traditionally statutes should be read.
Courts said in UARG and others that, that doctrine applies in cases of vast economic and political significance. And there's no bright line for that, I will concede. But I'm not sure this, you kind of know it when you see it. I'm not sure this really fits that moniker.
Well, certainly the amici before this court are saying that it does, the Chamber of Commerce, the Paramount brief saying that, you know, this is really going to reshape things if this interpretation were adopted. And again, I just think, you know, if you're reading the statute and trying to say, well, I could read it the way they are to jam internet in, is that really what the best way of understanding a statute like this, which does something unique and unusual, compulsory licenses, and did so because of very specific things they were reacting to, must carry regulation and sunk capital costs by cable systems? Hard to say that that's really, you know, that Congress's words here really meant something this broad.
That doctrine's when the agency's doing the pushing the envelope, and here obviously the agency's not doing that.
I think the agency has recognized the text as its best read is to be inherently localized, and you know, look, Congress can change it if they wanted to. Certainly Filmon's asked for that for any number of years and tried to go across the street, but they haven't done that. And
that's my concern about the elephants and mouse holes thing here, is it wasn't really a mouse hole in the way that some of these cases are, because it did say other communications channels, which should have alerted people, I think. This, I'm repeating myself now, but probably should have alerted people that, wait, what do we mean by other communications channels?
Again, you could read it that way, but then you'd have a really hard time explaining what Congress is doing with satellites and microwaves. So every time there are new technologies, Congress deals with them with legislation. They don't jam it into other communications channels. And that, we think, is very good evidence that our textual reading, even apart from tiebreakers or tiebreakers plus, is the correct reading.
Can I ask you just a few, they're not really hypotheticals, they're more to help my understanding about this. So on this mobile device question, if the transmission is by Wi-Fi or cellular, you're saying that's not included? I understand you're saying in the real world, they pay. But in the real world, the way we get the information on your phone that you would otherwise get from your cable system at home is through either Wi-Fi or through cellular. Those are not consistent with microwave, cable, wires like that.
That is correct. If you adopt their interpretation, it would be. But so, Chief Judge Garland, if you're at home and you have, you know, grabbed television signals over the air and then broadcast them on your Wi-Fi network to anyone who can grab them, yeah, I don't think that that's an other communications channel for
I'm talking about for myself. I'm talking about if the cable company provides not only to your home, but also to your device, and they do it by cellular or Wi-Fi. Why aren't those inherently localized medium of limited availability? I can guarantee you Wi-Fi, at least mine, is of limited availability.
So they're using a compulsory license to get it into your home?
I'm asking you, I'm not saying they're doing this. I'm asking you, could they? Why would this not be part of a cable system?
Well, this is, I'm sorry.
This is the additional transmission to your mobile device by Wi-Fi.
But you have the system has a compulsory license to get it into your home, and then the question is, can they carry it through to Wi-Fi or something like that? In that circumstance, I think it would go back to the underlying question of, if you've got a compulsory license to get it into someone's home, then I think, you know, distributing it, you know, to someone in that local path, I think would be permissible.
What about transmission?
It still sounds inherently localized.
Oh, somewhere else in the city.
That might be harder. That's not necessarily inherently localized anymore, and so that is broader.
It's still in your city.
Yeah, but that doesn't, to me, have the same kind of elements and hallmarks of what Congress said when they specified, you know, wires and cable, something much more local than the city. Cities are big, after all.
Of radio waves, and all this cellular and Wi-Fi are just either radio or microwave.
But again, I think even when microwaves were there, Congress, I think, had in mind kind of, you know, much more localized transmissions than, you know, you being able to grab it anywhere in the city. That's a harder question. This is an easier one.
Legislative history talks about wireless cable when they're talking about microwaves. Right. That's those are the words that they use in legislative history.
Correct, but again, I think that still refers to a very local, you know, area. I don't think it refers to anywhere in the city or as you travel on. It sounds more like satellites, you know, Chief Judge Garland. Satellites, you know, where you could really grab the signal wherever you happen to be, and that's where Congress enacted standalone legislation.
And if they showed, if they were able to show factually that their system transmits it to customers within the same geographic area as the facility and the local broadcast transmissions, and they control it to the best of their technological capacity. Nothing's perfect. Cable's not perfect. People hack into cable all the time.
Well, that's just their say-so.
I'm just asking you, then not take it anywhere you go in the country. They just say, we're going to let you have it. You know, if you've got a Wi-Fi router in your house, you can use the router part. You don't have to be plugged into a cable up in your study, even if you are in your living room. That would be okay.
No, that's just their say-so. That's certainly not okay. That's not making the technology inherently localized.
Is that a fact dispute?
No, I don't think it's a fact dispute at all. It's just not inherently localized. At that point, the transmission signal, again, and this goes back to our interchange earlier, when you use the internet, the transmission media is not localized. It is internationalized.
What if 119 and 122 expired? For right now, how does direct TV work?
I'm not sure. There's a separate compulsory license regime.
I understand, yeah. But if those expired, direct broadcast satellite TV uses microwaves to small dishes. So would that be covered by 111 then?
I mean, I suppose they try and jam themselves into calling themselves a microwave system and not a satellite.
They have to jam themselves because that's what they use.
Again, I'm not familiar enough with how DirecTV technology operates, and if it's purely a microwave-based technology system, then I assume that they would. But I think the whole point of Congress's standalone legislation was to say satellites, you know.
They do provide communications by microwave, do they have to get a spectrum license for that?
I don't know the answer. I'm sorry to that.
So I ask that question because in your argument about 111, you say you either own or rent the medium, and I'm wondering how you own or rent microwaves. Now, you do, obviously, radio broadcasters have to have a license. Do you know, or do you not know?
Well, you know, I do know that the Copyright Office has dealt with this microwave issue, and then this is at 56 Federal Register 31584, and pointed out that microwave systems the microwave systems own equipment at both ends, both the sending end, the head equivalent to the head end, as well as at the receiving end in people's homes, and that's very different than Philmon, which doesn't do any of that.
Okay, further questions? Thank you very much. I guess we'll have to give you a little more time.
A lot you want to say, and you can do it in whatever order you want, but at some point I hope you'll address whether these points about inherently localized and controlled, and whether it's a fact dispute or whether it is just the nature of the internet by its definition. It can't be fitted technologically and controlled in the way that they say.
Sure, Your Honor.
Start wherever you want.
I'll start with that. I think there is some issue. Obviously, this is it was our cross motion for summary judgment. First of all, to clarify that we've appealed, and there were cross motions. There were motions on both sides. Obviously, I think there are issues to the extent the court. Well, first and foremost, focusing solely on the language of 111F3, I think if the court's already identified, why don't we just construe it as written? And why are we having all these other terms that are inserted into it? And so that's the first response, is there's no need to consider inherently localized control of the transmission path or any of those things. They are not in the statute. To the extent the court is considering those, I think there are some factual disputes, whether or not there is, what does control of the transmission path mean? What is inherently localized?
Where does that phrase come from other than the courts? That I understand where the phrase inherently localized transmission, that comes from the agency. But where does the phrase controls the path of the signal and its destination?
There's language to that effect in the Communications Act.
Oh, uh-huh.
And essentially, the Communications Act requires actual control of the transmission path from end to end, which, again, glaringly absent from Section 111 F3. But to the extent the court is going to render an opinion based on...
Was that language enacted before or after the 1976 Copyright Act, the Communications Act language?
I believe it was after. Yeah, I believe that that act has been modified over time a lot more than the Copyright Act has. And I think that's another point that I wanted to get to. There's talk about the legislative history and it being vague and kind of going both ways, and I certainly admit that there are statements that go both ways, but I think one set of statements that needs to be clear and that is clear is that the Congress that enacted that this statute knew that there would be continuing evolving technology and that they took particular care that the language of the bill would be sufficiently flexible to allow for further evolution in technology and communications. That's cited in our brief at opening brief at page 20, reply at page 16. They stated, we must adapt the law to accommodate future change in the technology, which progress is bound to bring. This is what the court faces today. We have another communications channel.
The competing principle to that is the idea that courts should be careful about reading old statutory language to authorize some big new thing that was not specifically contemplated by Congress at the time. And so that's the competing, the elephants and mouse holes principle. And how would you suggest we reconcile those two things in this case?
Well, I think a lot of what's going on in this case is what Carl Llewellyn pointed out in 1950, that for every thrust, there's a parry of these canons of interpretation. So I think the court ought to be reluctant to adopt this sort of tiebreaker thought that, first of all, that there needs to be a tie that's broken. I don't think there does based on the plain language. But to the extent there is some concern about what Congress meant in 1976 and whether it meant to be open-ended, first of all, other communications channels or the language is important. But then we also have another act of Congress when it corrected in 1994 the microwave. So we have an agency here that the plaintiffs are pointing to that, again, has indisputably taken always a very narrow view of any exception to copyright. And we have Congress in one instance where there was a specific, again, it's important to notice and comment rulemaking. And that's when Congress has stepped in. It was when that's happened. It's happened with satellites. It was happening with satellites. The legislation was enacted prior to the formal notice rulemaking issuing, but the proceeding had begun, and it happened with microwaves after a notice and comment rulemaking. There has not been such thing here, so there's been no need for Congress to act, and so I think the court properly disposed of any acquiescence argument, and that's simply not true. Turning to a case that counsel, I think, tried to distinguish but couldn't describe, the Quality King versus Danza case. That is, in fact, a very important case that is on all fours when we go back to Charming Betsy. That case was dealing...
I don't think Charming Betsy was cited specifically by the advocates in that case, and the court... It does help you, I grant you, but it's unclear that the court really grappled with the full Charming Betsy.
Well, I agree with Your Honor, but what the court was grappling with was free trade agreements, which are cited here, exactly on point in that respect alone. And the court said those agreements shed no light at all. And the court was dealing, mind you, with an exception to copyright licenses in that case. There you had hair products that were shipped overseas. There was the first sale doctrine issue. They came back into the states. The copyright holder argued you couldn't do that, and that this exception needs to be narrowly construed. Charming Betsy prevents this. And among other things, the court said these treaties shed no light on the interpretation of the law. So I think Charming Betsy goes out the door with that case. Another point that I wanted to respond to, counsel said that there's no evidence that Philmon has spent anything on its technology. Well, there is, in fact, evidence. It's on the docket in the district court, 31-1 at page 6. There's at least $10 million that Philmon has spent in developing its technology. And it had numerous data centers, facilities around the country. And I'll say that, but then at the same time, I'll say, once again, language not in the statute. There's no requirement for an expenditure of X amount or Y amount in order to qualify as a cable system. It's simply not there. So all of these things that are being brought up are not in the language. And Congress drafted, we have to assume, with intent and purpose, and including, again, I know I've said it probably too many times, or other communications channels. The only way to give that meaning, because you can ask either one of us, you've asked me what's not, and I've said, well, there are a few examples, But if the internet is not another communications channel, what is? So that, I think, is the fundamental principle that the court has to answer. And again, as Your Honor pointed out, the internet does operate only on this physical layer of wires, cables, and microwave. There is technology available today, may or may not have been available when the IVI court was grappling with what it was. But again, very different facts there. So this notion that there are these six cases floating out there that are against us, there are two that are against us on our facts. And they are the WTTW case in the Northern District of Illinois, which is before the Seventh Circuit, and they are this case from the district court. And of course, there's the case in California where Judge Wu found that we were entitled to the extent we comply with the other provisions of the act. And I think, Judge Millett, when you started with by asking a question about the footnote at the end of their brief, and they started talking about, my friend started talking about, well, did they modify the programming? Do they do this or that? There are other things that Philmon X will still have to do once it gets the license. But those don't deprive it of the opportunity to get that license. In other words, they can still be liable for infringement of a variety of reasons after they have a compulsory license. And one of those things could be if there's an issue with local to local, if they transmit and somehow it leaks over into Canada or somewhere else, there's technology in place to prevent that. But as Your Honor has identified also, there's a lot of piracy that happens with every type of signal. And I've represented DirecTV in a number of cases dealing with signal piracy. So there's no way to get around that. And the fact that that may happen, the specter of piracy, certainly is no reason to read something into the statute that's not there. In terms of, again, going back to deference in the Copyright Office, when we're talking about the cases that are cited by the plaintiffs here, the MPAA and other cases, those are instances where the Copyright Office, number one, has issued a very specific rule or regulation. And most of those cases deal with something like copyright royalties, a more ministerial task that the Copyright Office is clearly tasked with. In the history of statements by the office.
Our court expressly rejected the argument that we only give deference to ministerial determinations. You used exactly those words. That was exactly the argument made in that case, the Cablevision versus MPAA case.
Well, I agree with Your Honor. And I'm simply pointing out that the case law, so I understand that there still may be, I invite the court to, under Skidmore, consider whether or not there are compelling reasons at the Copyright Office, and I think the court may well do that. That's what the district court did. That's what district courts have done across the country. In California, the district court looked at the Copyright Office and determined that due to the historical hostility, great care needed to be taken, and there should be a fresh look at the statutory language in this instance.
I'm trying to understand. I'm obviously missing something technologically here. You fight so hard against the Copyright Office's requirement that you be inherently localized. But then when I asked you, you said, yeah, we're inherently localized. So why are you fighting it? Why don't you just say you don't have to decide deference in this case because we think we meet it? And if that's true, tell me how you think you meet it.
Well, I think the issue is counsel's argument that once something touches the internet, it's all of a sudden available around the world. And therefore, it's not inherently localized. And I would put to the court that I don't think that the system in 1976 of an antenna on the hill with one wire that runs to my house and it touches nothing else, that doesn't exist anymore. There are easements that the FCC deals with. There are a number of issues. The world is interconnected. So the notion that somehow because a signal may travel on a path that I'm not following the entire route of, and therefore it's not localized, is simply...
Would you agree it's a physical matter that it goes to Russia and back? I thought they would go to exchange centers and would take the most efficient path, which presumably would not be via Russia. But I am not a technology expert, so I'm trying to understand...
Well, I agree with
why
Your Honor.
Is it available to the world, or do you guys have protections in place both through the encryption and the addressing that you're using to get it to the person and the nature of how this internet system works, that theoretically that's possible, but actually the way this electricity travels through the most efficient path, it doesn't take a long way around the world.
Well, I agree with Your Honor that it does, but it should take the most efficient path. But I think the issue is, and I've recognized the issue, and this is the issue that they've argued, the issue is that one can't predict the path that it will take, which it may determine is the most efficient, the data. And again, I'm sort of outside my league when I start talking about how it determines.
The general understanding of packet switching is it could go anywhere, and that the packets all get put back together. But there is no control that you can provide over the path the packets take. And it is the most efficient, but in this world, that can mean going around the world before it gets back.
I agree with Your Honor. I'm saying it can't be controlled. I believe it takes the most efficient path. But what I do know is that with the IP encoding, there is information on that packet that will not allow it to be intercepted or decoded by anyone else. And, of course, that does run the risk of, sure, is it conceivable that somebody in Russia would somehow crack things? I mean, obviously, we know that can happen. And it doesn't even have to leave here for that to happen, frankly. There are all sorts of ways in the interconnected world to wreak havoc and wreak mischief. It does take the most efficient path. Philmon has a number of technologies in place. They are the same technologies that are used, I suppose, according to counsel's representation, because it's not in the record, according to these private licenses or pursuant to these private licenses that internet or cable companies procure. And the other thing, during counsel's argument, he referred to cable companies as these little things or somehow, we're talking about some of the largest companies in the world. And we have a disruptive technology now that's trying to utilize what is efficient, what makes sense, to disseminate the public good of television, of broadcast over-the-air television, the news, emergency broadcast network, to people. And there are, in 1976, when people lived in rural areas and didn't have the ability to put an antenna up and receive signals, there are a body of people today who get their everything over the internet. So this court needs to look at the current status of technology, look back at what Congress intended, look at the statements of Congress and the broad language that Congress used. And I would say one last thing, that the fact that other communications channels may be broad does not render it ambiguous. So there's no need necessarily to go look to all these other sources to try to figure out what it means. If the internet is not another communications channel, what is? And if the court has no further questions, then I will submit.
Thanks very much. Excellent argument on both sides. We will take the matter under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.